Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim for the next Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The House plans to take up 5 of the 12 annual appropriations bills in one big bundle in an attempt to avoid another government shutdown this fall. The package would total nearly $1 trillion and combine spending bills for defense, labor, HHS, education, energy, water, state foreign operations, and legislative branch. The package would represent a significant majority of the $1.295 trillion spending limit set by the House in a, quote, deeming resolution. New discretionary spending limits have not actually been set. The House hopes to pass all of its appropriations bills by the end of June in order to allow time for negotiations with the Senate. But bundling is not a silver bullet, as last year's budget process thoroughly underscored. A $19.1 billion disaster aid package finally passed the U.S. House on a vote of 354 to 58. The Senate previously approved the package before the congressional recess. The bill now heads to the president, and he said he intends to sign it. It took 5 months to pass the bill, which provides relief to thousands of natural disaster victims. The bill had bipartisan support, but was objected to on multiple occasions by individual House members when it was placed on the consent agenda. Those members called for southern border aid to be included in the package and a full House vote, which eventually occurred. The final package does not contain funding to address the surge of migrants at the southern border. House appropriators are taking up the financial services spending bill that would provide an increase in funding to the IRS and a 3.1% pay increase for federal employees. The draft bill rings in at $24.55 billion, which is $1.4 billion over this year's level. The bill also includes $600 million in grants for states to safeguard voting systems. Lawsuits over the administration's plan to fund a southern border wall will require federal courts to explore uncharted territory. They will have to determine how explicit Congress has to be with regard to White House funding requests. The president was only granted $1.375 billion of the $5.7 billion he requested for a wall, but then he declared a national emergency to reallocate funds and achieve his desired funding amount. Congress has primary control over appropriations, but federal agencies have some ability to transfer funds within accounts they control. The Trump administration is arguing they have authority to make such transfers, and apparently there's no existing case law to provide guidance on the issue. A federal judge, however, just rejected a House lawsuit seeking to block the administration from using such transferred funds, but not on the substance of the issue. The judge said the House lacked the legal standing to bring the suit. A separate lawsuit in a different federal court last month resulted in a preliminary injunction to stop border construction. The Interior Environment Appropriations Bill that was approved by the House would cost $39.5 billion and contains a provision that would block oil and gas drilling offshore and in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Trump administration came out strong against the measure because it has been working to expand oil and gas drilling nationwide. A massive retirement savings bill is being tripped up by several senators. Objecting members have raised concerns over the bill, which previously passed the House 417-3. The bill would cost $16.8 billion over 10 years and would offer tax credits to help small businesses provide retirement plans to employees. Immigration has always been part of the United States social fabric, but it has not really been part of an economic growth strategy. A well-designed legal immigration policy can advance entrepreneurship, augment productivity gains, fill skills gaps, and combat demographically driven labor force declines. Especially at a time of record low unemployment and shortfalls of qualified workers, a new approach to immigration has the potential to be a powerful force for economic growth. The American Action Forum and the Concord Coalition recently released a comprehensive immigration reform plan that proposes focusing legal immigration on the economics of a productive labor force. You can find out more and read the report by visiting ConcordCoalition.org. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist mom Diane Lim will join me, and we'll be picking up where we left off several weeks ago when we were discussing the evolving economy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. She and Bob are regular contributors on the show, and this is our next Economist Mom segment. Welcome back.
Thanks, Chase.
Good to be with you.
So this week, we're continuing our discussion from several weeks ago on the evolving economy. And I'd like to carry over a little bit on this topic into our next session with the Economist Mom as well, because this is a pretty broad topic, a lot of nuance we could get into. In our Economist Mom segment, where we talked about this subject, we discussed how economic growth has changed, generally that the economy itself is changing, how the workforce is changing in makeup, productivity, and more. And I want to dig deeper on how some of our current systems might have to adapt to those changes. But before we really get down that road, I think it'd be good to have a little bit of a recap on what current demographics look like, what some of those trends are, and how it might already be impacting short or long-term economic growth.
Okay, well, I think that in terms of the foundation of our economy is its people. And so let's start with the demographics in terms of the age distribution of the population. The big driving factor in terms of what's affecting the financing of our major government programs is the aging of the population, of the U.S. population, and in particular, the rise in the number of retirement-age individuals and elderly relative to the working-age population. So this is a trend that we've known about for some time, the shift over time in the mix of people in terms of are they working versus retired, or are they children, dependent children versus in their working years. And this affects the financing of our major programs because it affects our tax system. Taxes are paid primarily by working age individuals, and it affects the amount of money that the government spends on entitlement programs, because those programs, those benefits go disproportionately to the above 65 population. So that's a big thing. It affects not only our big fiscal, the kind of fiscal parameters, but it affects the nature of our economy too. It's like who's in the kind of productive stages of their lives versus in the retirement stages. And so it affects our economy, and it in turn affects our fiscal outlook, the balance between taxes and spending.
And Chase, let me just add, to translate that into some budget numbers, today, 40% of non-interest federal spending, so let's forget about what we pay on the debt. Let's just talk about primary spending, which is what the government spends on its programs. 40% of non-interest spending goes to people age 65 or older, primarily through Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and federal retirement programs. Within 10 years, that number is projected to top 50%. So that's a big part of the federal budget, and it's the part that's growing faster than the economy. If you look at projections for federal spending, all of it on a programmatic level, aside from interest, is attributable to retirement or healthcare spending. That's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's just, it's a thing.
It's just how it is.
It has to be dealt with.
Yeah.
So, Bob, you mentioned the budget figures that are impacted by this demographic shift. Do you also have any numbers that can make the population a little more tangible, like about what percentage of the population is retiree versus, you know, remains in the workforce or younger?
Well, I have some worker to beneficiary ratio numbers in front of me going back in time. And so it's interesting to look at that. You can kind of look going back to about 1940, and you can see that when Social Security began, which was in the mid-30s, we had a very high ratio of covered workers to beneficiaries. And then it kind of leveled out over time. It came down. It started at, this is going to sound a little ridiculous, but in 1940, it was almost 160 covered workers to every retired beneficiary.
Yes, that does sound ridiculous.
But then it does sound insane right now. 1950, it came down to 16.5, 1960, 5.1. 1970, 3.7. And then for decades, it was in the, 3 to 4% range, but covering right around a little less than 3.5 workers per beneficiary. And that it kind of hit a local peak in the 80s and 90s, which is basically when the baby boomers were in their prime age working years. So we had a swell in the population between 1946 and 1964 that's known as the baby boom generation. It showed up in the worker to beneficiary ratio once those baby boomers were of working age. So that took a while. And then once those baby boomers started to retire, that's when we started to see the worker to beneficiary ratio start to come down. So now it's below 3 workers per covered beneficiary, and it's projected to go to keep declining for the next several decades. So that's sort of the mechanics of generational demographics. It's largely driven by the fact that different generations or different cohorts of people have been of different sizes, and not just absolute size, but relative to each other. And that when the ratio of young workers or prime age workers relative to retirement age beneficiaries changes, that translates into changes in the amount of revenue that Social Security and the whole federal system takes in relative to the amount of spending that the federal government needs to do for these retirement age programs.
And I want to talk about both those things, actually, Diane. The first thing I want to discuss is you mentioned that the worker to beneficiary ratio is expected to continue to decline. Is that a permanent decline? Does it plateau at a certain point? I guess ultimately what I'm trying to get at is this an issue where that ratio eventually starts to reverse itself and we can weather this storm? So that's the first question. The second question goes to what you were just saying and discussing its impact on programs like Social Security and Medicare. And I want to dig into that a little bit once we get a little more intel on that future projection of the ratio.
Yeah, so I have that the 2030 ratio is 2.4. I don't know. Does that keep going down?
It pretty much levels off around there. And that's because, you have the maturing of the system, basically. But I think a lot of people get the impression that when the baby boomers die off, the problem will be solved.
It'll reverse.
And that's not the case. It just, what it does is it stabilizes at that level. We have lower birth rates and longer lifespans, and that, in the long-term projections, it stays at a fairly low, ratio.
Right. So both of those factors that you just mentioned, Bob, the lower fertility, lower birth rates, and longer lives, longer time periods that everyone spends in those retirement age years, it just naturally works to keep decreasing the worker to beneficiary ratio, even though we don't have quite the same phenomenon of the, like, a generational swell, like the baby boomers going away. Or...
So you're not gonna, you can't just get rid of us baby boomers to solve the problem.
Right.
Dang it.
You're gonna have to start having more babies to get rid of the problem rather than just kill off the baby boomers.
That or immigration.
To answer one of your earlier questions, to tie that in, we got right now about 16% of the population is 65 or older, and that's going to go up to 20% just within the next 10 years. And that's the effect of the baby boomer retirement. But, you know, the aging of the population is going to keep that. We should think of this as a permanent aging of the society.
Right.
And following up on my second point, both for you, Diane, and Bob, you were starting to get into how this change is impacting the revenues and benefits of programs like Medicare and Social Security. Most of our systems are structured in sort of this pay-as-you-go manner. Like there's no account that's being stored up for each of us as we're paying into it for our retirement, but it's current workers right. pay for current beneficiaries. So maybe explain for our listeners a little bit in more detail about how this demographic change is impacting the revenue for Social Security and the revenue for Medicare and the resulting expenditures.
Right. Well, you know, when Social Security started, there's sort of a startup effect. You know, it's you're not in the steady state of the program. When you first start, you have newly entered participants paying into the system, and you have relatively few, small numbers of people collecting the benefits, but a lot of those initial beneficiaries hadn't paid into the system either. So at first, we had a high ratio of workers to beneficiaries. It was current, at the time, it was current workers that were paying taxes. It was current retirees that were receiving benefits. There weren't as many elderly in that qualifying for benefits category because people weren't living as long as they do today, obviously. So the finances of the system, especially initially, were very strong. They were, you know, we were able to take in a lot more revenue than we were paying out in benefits. And then when the baby boom generation came on, that sustained it. This was a swell in the population. When those people born between 1946 and 64 came of working age, there was a huge increase in the wage base to our economy and the tax base for the Social Security system relative to the generations that had come before the baby boom, which are relatively smaller retiree generations. So this is a means of financing a program that we wouldn't necessarily set up today. If we were starting from scratch, we wouldn't say, oh, let's set it up so that whatever the size of the working age generation today, they're going to pay for the benefits of whatever the size of the retirement age population today. We wouldn't set it up that way because we know that the relative magnitudes of the sizes of the generations are going to change over time, and it's hard to predict that, and it's hard to get it right, like what should be the tax rate that goes with these to support these future retirees. We don't know how we might change the retirement age. We don't know how fertility will change over time, what new workers will come on board to participate in the system. And so I think it's just an artifact. You know, we inherited the system that was started so long ago without anticipating, and it was started at a time when I'm sure there wasn't much anticipation of the baby boom generation to come.
No, they weren't even anticipating World War II.
Right, they weren't anticipating, the peak in fertility that would happen, 10 years later. So, and then even after the baby boom generation was done being born, you know, like once it became apparent in the late 60s that, oh, we're not going to be producing as many babies as we have been for the past two decades, it was pretty much known at that time. Experts could have, budget people could have certainly said, oh, this is not going to work out a little ways from now. This is going to, cause a mismatch. And yet, there was no need to do anything at that time. You know, we've known that there would be this generational issue in terms of the financing of Social Security for ever since the baby boom generation stopped being born, essentially. But there was no need to act upon it, even if we kind of had a hint that the financing, the taxes relative to benefit ratio would inevitably, obviously change. And so nothing was really done about it until it became more of an more of a closer problem.
It was an acute crisis in what was it, 1977?
Yeah, the late 70s. Right.
They were on the. There was one round of reform in the late 1970s, and it wasn't enough. And then they got into the.
In the 83,
early,
they had to do something
80,
else, right?
Because there wasn't enough money to pay the benefits. And that's the definition in Washington of a crisis, is Social Security checks are not going out.
Right. And frankly, that's probably what's going to happen going forward because, you know, I just said if we were starting over, if we were starting from scratch, we wouldn't design it this way. But we aren't starting from scratch. We've been living with this program that's a very popular program, and it's hard to change benefit structures once you've started making those commitments. And so chances are that this is the way we're going to proceed with Social Security going forward, is every time we get close to a crisis where checks can't be paid out, we will make necessary adjustments so that the checks continue to go out.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Economist Mom Diane Lim in our recurring segment, The Economist Mom, and we're discussing how the economy has changed, how different systems might need to be reformed in order to adapt. And Bob, I know you wanted to jump in right there, but I had to check in with our listeners. Go ahead and continue giving us an update on what reform was like back in the 70s and 80s.
Well, it led to something that's been bedeviling our politics ever since. And part of it has to do with the language that's used. We tend to think to talk about Social Security as if it were a private sector insurance program that can be pre-funded, or your retirement account that can be pre-funded. But Social Security is a government program, and that means that the federal government is collecting the money and spending the money. There's this thing called the trust fund, which is an accounting device, but it doesn't affect the economics of the situation. So what happened in brief is that the 77 reforms weren't enough to keep the system going, so they decided to really fix the problem with the 83 reforms, and they didn't want to have to revisit it again. So the decision was made to, in effect, run a surplus in the system, not the sort of pay-as-you-go system that Diane was talking about. And you have and it happened beyond their wildest dreams. The economy kicked in, and they brought in a lot more revenue than was expected. So back in the 1980s, the Social Security program was a gusher for the government. It was bringing in a lot of revenue, much more than was needed to pay benefits. So we had this big Social Security surplus, which masked a big deficit in the rest of the budget. And you got this thing about people debating, well, what should we do with the Social Security surplus? Well, basically, the government has no choice. I mean, the money comes in, and it has to do something with it, so it spends it on bills that it has to pay. You know, you can argue about they shouldn't have done that, but they did. And a IOU was credited as the Social Security Trust Fund, and the problem is that IOU has to be paid by the Treasury. Mm-hmm. So it's the government crediting itself with spending authority, basically. So, you know, what looked good on paper from the point of view of paying Social Security benefits, running up a big Social Security surplus, which could be theoretically drawn down in the future to pay the baby boomer retirement benefits. That still works on paper, except that the Treasury now has to come up with the money. It's the flip side of what happened in the 80s. Instead of Social Security being a gusher, Social Security on a cash basis is a drain on the federal budget and is adding to the deficit. And so if you were to design a program going forward, you know, the last thing I'd want to do is to try to build up another quote unquote trust fund surplus that would confuse the heck out of everybody. I think we should be looking at a system where you're basically trying to keep the income and the outgo relatively stable, and maybe that means a reform that looks at, you know, five-year increments or something like that with a regular look back, like not just whenever Congress feels like it. It's like a five-year reset every year just to look at what you're going to set for the revenue. You can't do five-year adjustments to benefits because people have to plan their retirement around it. So it's much easier to change the tax equation than the benefit equation.
And incidentally, you know, that is the trust fund is the difference between, relates to the difference between the gross debt and the net debt. You know, so we're, you know, economists don't like people talking about the gross debt, which is includes the debt that's owed to the Social Security fund or other government funds, other government trust funds. But in effect, you know, even though economically it's the net debt, it's the debt that the government owes to others that is the real economic debt. If you think about what needs to be dedicated, what we need to have available to pay for programs, the gross debt is sort of important to keep in mind that, you know, we owe a lot. We do owe a lot to the Social Security system because we've been taking from it.
So, Diane, we've discussed that the worker-to-beneficiary ratio has changed and it's unlikely to reverse anytime soon, that that's not really going to be some kind of cure for the Social Security system. We've talked about how the benefits and revenues are being impacted by that demographic change. And you mentioned that, at least for the short term, we might be sort of stuck in this cycle of making small tweaks here and there to sustain the system for current beneficiaries. But if you're looking forward at reforms to Social Security and how we use it and how we fund it for this changing economy, what could you either predict will happen or you hope would happen to the system to make it either more fiscally responsible and also viable for this economy?
Yeah, well, all of the, if you look at any kind of sensible and carefully crafted proposal for Social Security reform, what it looks like, typically, it emphasizes the fact that our population is aging and people are able to work longer than they were able to work decades ago. And so one adjustment is that's often proposed is to increase the retirement age. A second adjustment is that if you look at who benefits from Social Security, it's a universal program in the sense that anyone who works contributes Social Security taxes, and when they retire, they're entitled, that's why we call it an entitlement program, to Social Security benefits. And this is regardless of income level. And so one criticism of Social Security is often that it spends a lot of money on retirement age people who don't need the money, like in terms of people who have plenty of personal savings on their own. They didn't need the kind of forced saving that Social Security provides and the guaranteed minimum income that Social Security provides because they were well enough off and had high enough incomes during their careers to do plenty of saving and rely on their own saving and not have to rely on government assistance. So, you know, a lot of proposals change the progressivity of the Social Security system by giving less generous benefits to higher income households and relatively more generous benefits to lower income households. Social Security is already a progressive system in that the net benefit is a higher percentage of income for lower income households than higher income households. But proposals for reform often seek to make that progressivity even greater.
My follow-up to that would be, what are some of the more progressive reforms that can make that kind of adaptation within the system, especially when you're looking at a higher cost for retirement, not necessarily even in just Social Security, the system itself, but looking at, say, millennials and Gen Xers who in a couple decades are going to want to leave the workforce themselves and trying to figure out how Social Security fits in. How do you think this program could look for them? And are there ways that you can change how we fund the system or how benefits are paid out that are also somewhat predictable?
Well, yeah, another issue is if we just look at Social Security taxes, the tax side of the system is fairly antiquated in the sense that It's limited to traditional employment relationships, and we have something called the Social Security taxable maximum income, which means that if you earn up to, I think it's in the $110,000 to $120,000 range right now per year, anything beyond that is not subject to additional Social Security taxes. So your tax, that's why they call it the taxable maximum level of income. What that does is it makes Social Security taxes a proportional tax up to that maximum. And then beyond that, it becomes a regressive tax, which just means that the percentage of income tax declines at incomes above that taxable maximum. So the share of income that's subject to the Social Security tax declines. And so that makes it what economists like to call regressive above that maximum income level. So both of those are somewhat problematic in today's economy, A, because we need more revenue. So the taxable maximum is something that people propose to raise or even get rid of. That's a way of bringing more revenue in relative to the benefit structure. And B, the fact that it is tied to employment and traditional employment, like wages that are reported on a W-2 versus a 10, and not the kind of income that's reported on 1099, employers withhold Social Security taxes, and they contribute their share of Social Security taxes. But if you change employers during the year, the clock kind of starts over with the new employer. The new employer doesn't know how much in wages you earn from the previous employer that you worked for through June, say, and you move to a second employer. And you may very well, in the course of the year, pass that taxable maximum threshold. But if you started over with a new employer, they start the clock at zero again. So you end up, by the end of the year, paying more in Social Security taxes than you ultimately owe. You get the excess back as an income tax refund. But it's one example of how the Social Security system was set up and the whole financing system was set up at a time when the economy and the nature of work relationships looked very different, when people had a tendency to stay with one employer and to have a traditional work relationship on a, with wages reported on a W-2, and typically had only one employer for many years. Like many people, you know, in the 50s and 60s would start working for one employer and spend their entire career with that one employer. And so not only Social Security is tied up through that one employer, but also lots of other benefits, like, you know, health care benefits and retirement, you know, employer-provided retirement or private retirement savings programs. So a lot of the way Social Security was structured and a lot of the problems right now in the financing not quite keeping up with how people actually work these days is tied up in that changing nature of the employer-employee relationship. So I think that part of the reform, like if we were to make a bolder reform, it wouldn't just be let's raise Social Security tax rate to take in more revenue. Let's raise the retirement age so that it helps hold down benefits. Let's reduce benefits on the retirement age working population. Those are all ways of tweaking the parameters of the existing system. But if we really wanted to change those Social Security or some form of what is known as an old age insurance policy, we would change how we collect the revenue, that the revenue would be tied to individuals and not just an individual's employment relationship. The benefits would be tied to an individual's, like, income levels more directly, and maybe their needs in terms of the kind of services they need in old age, in retirement, apart from just thinking of it in cash terms, thinking of it in what kind of services are needed and where is the greatest support from government needed. So I think that those would be much bolder solutions. I am not optimistic that it would be easy to get to a bold situation like that. But I think that's what we need to start thinking about is how is our current economy and society so differently structured from what from how it was when the Social Security system was originally created as an old age insurance program.
That actually leads me into one of the other topics I really wanted to cover today, and that is health care. Programs like Medicare also benefit our retirement population, and we've spent a lot of time talking about Social Security specifically. But when you look at health care broadly and programs like Medicare that are part of that health care provision system within our nation, do you think there are bold changes there that can help adapt programs like that for future generations or help better tie revenue generation for Medicare and the benefits being paid out?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the, you know, when you think of old age insurance, you know, it's not really a traditional, we don't have a need to insure against old age. We pretty much know most of us will get to old age. What we have a need to insure against is the uncertainty about what kind of health care we're going to need, what kind of care we're going to need in old age, and how long we're going to live, right, in the state that needs, in a condition that requires a lot of healthcare services. One problem with our Medicare system, which is the health government provided healthcare system for the elderly, one problem is that it doesn't cover, and a lot of people don't realize this, it covers kind of traditional medical services, healthcare services. It does not provide, it does not cover long-term care like assisted living type services. And that is becoming an increasing problem in terms of people being able to financially manage their old age part of life. Because if you are in, if you're an older person that doesn't need so much traditional medical like hospital care, but needs constant companion care because you can't remember to take your medicine, you need assistance to do to perform daily tasks of living. That those kind of services, because you don't need hospital type doctor physician care, are not covered by Medicare. And so a lot of people have that misunderstanding. They don't realize that all of us actually right now need to prepare ourselves. We need to be prepared for lengthy periods of our life where we will need the assistance of other people. And it's not considered traditional health care that we need, but more companion care or assistance care. And so I think if Medicare, I think if a government program that is supposed to insure against the struggles of old age, that is one way in which our entire federal system, whether it's Social Security or Medicare, is sort of failing us, is falling short. And that is going to become an increasing need going forward, because as people are living longer, they are not just spending extended periods of time in this retirement phase of life, but they're actually spending lengthy periods of time where they don't necessarily need to sit in a hospital, but they do need someone to be with them all the time to provide companion caregiving that is not currently covered by any form of traditional health insurance or Medicare.
And Diane, how do you, I guess a question I have hearing how Medicare might need to be adapted for an aging population, how do you balance the cost that might come along with providing those kind of services with the current push to expand Medicare or move into a universal health care system and introducing that younger generation, that younger population into, I guess, the tax base and then the benefit base for programs like that? How do you balance the immense cost of old age health care provision with the broader population? Because it looks like we're heading down a path that's gonna put us in both categories. And much like the burden on individual taxpayers for Social Security seems to be going up as that ratio changes, it almost seems like we're heading that way with health care. So how do you find a balance there?
Well, you know, I think that the key is that we have government programs that are delivered, that primarily deliver benefits in old age, that younger people can feel like they are willing to pay it forward. They're willing to contribute taxes to the system for the promise of being supported when they need it in their old age. I think that young people, current workers, are willing to pay higher taxes and would be willing to pay even more in taxes if they knew that the government retirement age programs would be more of an insurance, more of an insurance policy for them against the uncertainties of what is the quality of life going to be for them in old age, and are they going to have adequate care of all sorts, not just medical care. So I think that's key, is like having a social system, a social insurance system, that young and old people are happy to participate in. It's also being as inclusive as possible in terms of who's participating. So it's getting the broadest base of taxpayers into the system, which means that we have to look beyond the traditional employment relationship. It means trying to recruit more taxpayers. That means, you know, encourage people, support families, encourage education, which raises wages and raises the tax base, encourage immigration, especially of workers in the fields that we need the most, which is, by the way, healthcare and nursing care services, given our aging population. So there are ways of kind of making it all fit together, which is you have to tackle these problems from both ends. You do have to look at what are the needs of the population that's collecting the benefits, and what are the sources of revenue, and not just revenue for tax sake, but revenue in terms of the economic, the strength of our economy, the economic base. And I think that if policymakers started looking at it more holistically, as this is a system, this has something to do with each other. Like when people when people value the kind of services that government programs provide, they're going to be more willing to pay the taxes that support those programs. So I think that unfortunately, our system was started when times were very different, when the demographics and the economy, the nature of the economy was very different, and we haven't adapted. The system hasn't kept up well with the changes in our society. And the most promising routes for reform going forward would be for policymakers to not just look narrowly at one program or one part of the program versus other programs and other parts of programs, but to look at the whole federal and state and local government tax and transfer system a little bit more holistically, and with a little bit more attention to how the needs of the population and the productivity of the population is changing over time.
I actually think that is a great place to leave it for this week, Diane, because in our next Economist Mom segment a couple weeks from now, we're going to dive a lot deeper into a lot of those issues, discussing the changing nature of work, ways we can craft the tax code to adapt to that changing economy, as well as things like workforce investment. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during our Economist Mom segment. We picked up where we left off concerning the nation's evolving economy, how current systems and structures are impacted by demographics and how they might need to change. And as I mentioned in the next Economist Mom, we'll dive into some new topics concerning workforce investment and tax code structure. Thanks again for joining the show.
Thanks, Chase.
You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.